It's like a little show every day.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call into session this meeting of the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is February 17th, 2015, and I am co-chair David Gomberg. Co-chair Senator Johnson is testifying at another hearing, so she suggested we go ahead and move forth without her, but she'll be joining us when she can. Ms. Dyser, you were going to give us a quick update.
Yes, I wanted to kind of orient you to where materials are in under meeting materials. I split them out by date, thinking that liquor would be yesterday's item. So the slides that we didn't finish yesterday will be under yesterday's date for meeting materials. The slide deck related to Measure 91 and marijuana is going to be under today's date for meeting materials. So you may need to switch back and forth. The other thing I wanted to let committee members know is that also in yesterday's meeting materials is a draft of the Joint Interim Task Force on Liquor Issues report. And we also included some follow-up information from OLCC on the location of their enforcement officers and the redemption centers for recycling. So that is all under yesterday's meeting materials as well. So again, if you have any questions or can't find something that you're looking for, wave your arms madly and I will do my best to endeavor to assist you.
Any questions for staff? All right, well, I'll go ahead and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5520 relating to the financial administration of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Mr. Marks, Mr. Patridge, welcome back. I see you brought reinforcements. When last we met, we had about 20 pages left to go on yesterday's material, plus we're going to cover today's material, so don't let any grass grow under your feet. Please.
Very good. Bill Schutte will continue on with the warehouse shipping capacity packet.
For the record, Bill Schutte, economist for the Liquor Control Commission. Yesterday we left off at the big picture, the things that we're asking for to improve our productivity, increase our shipping capacity. The first option we're looking at is POP Policy Option Package 104, increasing OLC warehouse shipping capacity. The quick overview for this is that OLCC warehouse, we believe, has reached a maximum shipping capacity of 3 million cases per year. I'll go into why we have come to that conclusion. This limitation on shipping capacity may put up to $75 million of gross liquor sales at risk to the 1517 biennium. Risk means delayed shipments, out of stock of product, potential lost sales, and potentially $1.1 billion in gross liquor sales over the next 10 years. So our solution to this is a capital expenditure of $5.02 million to modernize the existing conveyor system with automated sortation software. This will enable the warehouse to ship through multiple doors, up to five doors at the same time, and more than double our shipping capacity with no increase in FTE. So the problem right now, if you've been to our warehouse or you haven't been to our warehouse, it's a very linear system. The conveyor system dates back at least to the early 70s. Everything goes through a single portal. So right now we're shipping an average of about 12 hours per day or about 60 hours per week through that single portal. If you go to other places benchmarked to some big wine warehouses we visited, they're shipping an average of 40 hours a week. In fiscal year 2014, we shipped 2.95 million cases. In fiscal year 2016, we expect to ship 3.1 million, and in 2017, 3.2 million cases. The other number that is not up here is that on average we can process about 950 cases per hour. So multiplying that times the 12 hours times the number of work days kind of gets us to our shipping capacity limitation with the current FTE. Current FTE, we have 47.5 divided into two shifts on the warehouse floor who receive, store, and ship an average of about 62,500 cases per employee in 2014. We'll make note of that number because I'll show you some historical data about where we are now versus where we've been in the past. And then other limitations we're running in besides FTE is that our warehouse IT management system needs to process orders generally between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. So there's an issue between shipping and ordering. And then probably the biggest one is just pure logistics. Trucks need to be loaded by 8 p.m. to ensure next day delivery to destinations outside of the Portland metro area. So our shipping starts at about 7 o'clock in the morning up until about 2 in the afternoon. Portland trucks, Portland metro area, shipments are loaded. After 2 o'clock, shipments destined for outside of the Portland metro area are started to be loaded. They're often taken to transfer yards and then moved the next day. And the risks we're running into is that trucks loaded after 8 p.m. Are having a hard time making next day delivery to their destinations outside the Portland metro area. So here's a schematic picture of our warehouse. Again, a very linear system. You can see the cases being loaded on the upper left-hand corner. On the lower right-hand corner is the choke point, the single door. The cases backing up the conveyor system. They're all scanned before they go into the trucks. We deliver single cases to liquor stores. Liquor stores are set up in a way that they don't have a lot of storage space, so we are really the inventory system for our liquor stores in the state, so they can devote more of their space to retail. So these trucks are loaded, you know, pretty much sequentially. They are scheduled through the day. About 25, 26 trucks per day come through the OLCC warehouse. Looking at past productivity constraints, we've kind of established some relative control limits to what we can do labor-wise as far as case production. Again, besides shipping, we also have to receive the product and store the product. Back in 1990, we were averaging about 50,000 cases per employee. That gradually rose through about 2004, where we hit a high of about 61,000 cases per employee. But at that point, we also reached a limitation back in 2004, and the solution at that time was to add FTE. And so that pushed us below the 60,000 case per employee level. Back in 2008, we bumped back up again. We added more FTE. We added FTE again in 2010. But again, as you can see in 2014 on the far right side, we are beyond that, and we are currently at the 62,520 case per employee level above the red line. So our solution really is not to add more FTE this time.
Yes, Representative Whitson.
I'm sorry, I missed part of the presentation here. If you get the new conveyor system, will you be reducing your FTE then?
The plan with co-chair Senator Whitson, the plan is to keep the same number of FTE but actually redirect them. We have excessive number of FTE on what they call a swing shift towards the evening. We would probably relocate a number of those back to the day shift, and that would be the primary shipping window.
Thank you.
In the appendix for a presentation, we did a business case for this. These are some of the financial results. We believe our $5 million investment will be paid back within a couple of months after the actual installation and offsetting revenue at risk. It's a very positive return on investment, offsetting up to the $1.1 billion revenue at risk over the next 10 years without hopefully adding FTE. This is something we view as a long-term investment. This isn't a two-year or three-year investment. This is a 10-year solution to the problem we're facing. And we also realistically have to look at, you know, what the value of this would be in the event that Oregon no longer is in the liquor business, such as what happened in Washington. So the resale value of a system like this is unknown. It will depend on which buyer uses the current facility. But as a reference, we know that the conveyor systems can often be resold at about 35% of current value. So OLCC's recommendation is to invest $5 million into the system. This will enable the warehouse to ship through five doors at the same time, increasing shipping capacity by more than double, 140%, and securing vital revenue streams. The picture on the right is an actual sortation system. You see the cases going down a single line on the left. Then they're automatically scanned and diverted into other conveyor systems that can go out to simultaneous doors or portals at the same time.
Any questions? Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Gomberg, and You said you work a swing shift there. Does that go from like 5 to midnight, or what is the hours of that
swing shift? The swing shift is from 3 o'clock to midnight.
Is there? Do you run a graveyard shift then?
No. We run a full day shift from 7 to 3 or 7 to 3:30, and then a swing shift from 3 to midnight. The original purpose of the swing shift was, when it was brought on, was for replenishment, to move product into the building and close to the conveyor lines, but we're finding we're having to use the swing shift more and more for shipping now, as shipping is extended into the evening.
Can I follow?
Follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is it possible that you could do a graveyard shift that would kind of get the maximum out of that conveyor belt?
Yes, co-chair is Representative Nierman. That is one of the possibilities we've evaluated. Again, we run into the IT constraints. That is not insurmountable about between shipping and ordering at the same time. There are issues, of course, with the shipping companies. One of the logistics issues is that our liquor stores only receive shipments while they're open. So there's certain hours they want to receive shipments. They would also like to receive shipments while they're at their least busiest. So that means not Friday or Saturday, and especially in the evenings. And many of them are not also, some of them are not open on Sundays as well. But that is a possibility we could look at, and we have discussed it. But we believe that this is the best solution, you know, bring us into the 20th century at least.
Thank you.
Any other questions? The roof.
The roof. Our next policy option package is a warehouse roof replacement. The problem, we had an expanding number of leaks resulting in infrastructure damage and ongoing relocation of product, and I'll show you what that exactly means. We have two warehouses in our Milwaukee facility area. One was built in 1954 with additions in 1977 and 91, about 174,000 square feet total. And then we have a second facility that was purchased back in 2007 but was built in 1977. Less than a mile away, with about 105,000 square feet total. The Millport facility is used mostly for shipping, receiving bulk product, and then it's transferred to the McLaughlin facility for shipping out. When we noticed the expanding number of leaks, we hired an engineer in March of 2014 to do a full assessment of both warehouses, and the findings were that in the McLaughlin warehouse, which includes the office facility as well, 10 of 18 roof areas are failing and need to be replaced now, or about 62,000 square feet, and the entire Millport roof can no longer be repaired and must be replaced. These are the areas in question here. The pink area on the left is our McLaughlin facility. The pink areas are the areas that need to be replaced. These are priority one, where the current roof system is failing and recommended replacement. On the right is our full Millport warehouse facility, where the entire roof needs to be replaced. Of note here also is that this will probably not be the first time we'll be back before this committee to ask for money, at least this biennium, but in coming biennium, there are other sections of the roof that still have some life left, but will eventually be need replacement as well. And those are characterized by the orange areas.
Representative Whitsitt.
Is the roof flat?
Yes. It's a flat roof.
When you replace it, excuse me.
Follow up?
When you replace it, are you going to put a different roof on it? Because sometimes flat roofs in obviously really wet climates tend to deteriorate quicker than, so are you going to put a hip roof or just the same replace a flat with flat?
Co-chair is Representative Whitsitt. It will be the same flat roof, but it will be new materials. It will be an improved drainage system for the existing roof. It will come up to code. There are certain code modifications that have to be made when you replace roofs, especially with skylights and that sort of thing. But it will still remain a flat roof.
Thank you.
Please.
So here are roof issues, pictures of them on the far upper left, leaks occurring frequently in the warehouse. Oftentimes, we'll have to relocate product. But in the middle photo and down lower in the center here, we've actually created tarps to divert the water off product. The left shows wood structural damage is starting to occur, and the right hand is the actual membrane on top of the millport roof, which is literally starting to crumble and fall apart. Again, this was original roof from 1977. They are expected to have approximately about a 40-year lifespan, but and we're reaching that lifespan, but I guess their estimate was off by a few years. One of the questions that was raised yesterday was a question related to the HVAC system. We had some original requests too to replace some parts of our HVAC, which includes the boiler and heating systems. There are a couple of HVAC units on the top of the roof that are need to be replaced. In the engineering assessment, those were originally assessed to be not for next biennium, but the biennium following that. They have a little bit of useful life. However, those HVAC units will have to be lifted off the roof anyway to replace the roof. And since we have the since we have the crane in place, I think Senator Johnson was asking about perhaps being more efficient in replacing those few HVAC units, which only result in about $55,000 earlier, sooner than rather than later.
Good. For the record, Steve Marks, Director of OLCC, going to cover the online liquor licensing and payments. This project was elevated as a priority because, one, it's the entry point for our customers working with us, but also for us, it's the fundamental point at which we capture all data on our licensees coming in. So it was fundamentally important to us. The business drivers here are the growth of licensees and service permit processing, our need to modernize and improve customer service, and then our ability to share intergovernmental data with both our state partners and our cities and counties. The project objectives are to improve customer service, improve information availability for OLCC, and to streamline our regulatory process. As a part of the process of setting up the licensing system will be to delineate what all license type needs are in that system. So we think that it'll help us actually think through streamlining our licensing process as we develop the system. The outcomes are to accept liquor licenses and service permit applications online, allow applicants to pay online with e-commerce, and to then integrate application data with our existing systems. This is fundamentally important because this touches almost all business operations inside of our administrative processes. Our approach is to have a small-scale enhancement to the existing systems, the single focus on online processing. It's a small development contract augmented by our OLCC staff. Low-cost project costs are $305,000. It's small in scope, minimal complexity, and low risk. And the modern design technology here is it's going to be a web-based application for an agency just coming out of COBOL. That's a jump to the future. So that is the primary technology program we're advancing now. It's our priority. We have many, many other technology programs to catch up with, but we are finishing COBOL. This was our highest priority to move forward with in this biennium. I'd like to shift now to our legislative package, if there aren't any questions on e-commerce.
Questions from the committee?
So there is House Bill 2880. It is our license application fee proposal. We discussed it some yesterday. I'll just briefly cover the highlights of that again. It allows OLCC to charge a liquor license application fee for annual license applications or changes in ownership, not renewals. It's a tiered application fee, not to exceed $150. The fee will be refundable if we fail to meet our application target day. So this is an innovation to increase our timeliness with our own processes. We expect it to impact 4,330 licensed applicants. and it's expected to generate at least, and this is an estimate, at least $324,000 in 15-17. And then, as we said, all our revenues.
Quick questions.
I'm sorry. Yes, Senator.
You have 4,300 new or change of ownership applicants per year?
Yes, that's what we expect in the estimate for the item.
Is that built? I'm assuming it's based on a history that's realistic?
Yes. Mr. Chair, sounds, Senator Hansel, yes.
It seemed like a lot to me. So,
yeah. So Senator Hansel, that's a biennium number two. So that's 4,300 new applicants every biennium.
That helps a little bit, yeah.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, you said that the high end of the application fee would be $150. What's the low end, like if I'm just having beer fest in my neighborhood or something like that?
Chair Gomberg or Rep. Nierman, I can't answer that right now because we haven't set those, but we would be setting them with the legislation to give us the authority to put those in place on the different tiers.
Thank you.
Representative Nierman, if you were just having a beer fest, that would fall under a temporary license fee, and that would not be subject to this application fee.
Thank you.
And Representative Witzig.
So, since I don't know this, you have 4,330 licensed applicants, about 4,000 every 2 years. And how many of those get approved? And the ones that don't get approved, why don't they get approved, and do they get any part of their application fee back, or do you just sort of you apply and then hope you get approved? That's several questions.
I'll take that on. I think our next slides actually get to your question a bit there, and if they don't. So the current challenges are that OLCC's current license fees are some of the lowest in the nation. The license fees are collected only if the license is granted. Okay. The license applicant right now risks little because there's no fee or charge for applying for a license. And the applicants that begin the process, you know, unprepared or uncommitted, slow the overall speed with which we can deal with all license applications. So staff resources are diminished in that process. I'd say the benefits of the change would be by requiring a non-refundable fee. The applicant's value of the process is higher and more commitment when they move in. Businesses will begin to the licensing process, you know, more prepared to go through it. And the bill, House Bill 2480, allows OLCC to recoup the cost for staff resources spent on license investigations regardless of the applicant's preparedness. So we think for those that are committed by essentially weeding out some of these other time-consuming processes, that we'll be able to actually speed the process for other applicants and to help us deal with the growth and license permits, licenses. As our licensing director said, you know, if we can save them a day in the license process, we probably covered their costs by the fee imposed here.
So, Mr. Marks, just make sure I understand here. I'm opening up a new facility. I'm spending $500,000 to put it together, and you think a $150 non-refundable fee is going to give me the incentive to pay more attention to my application?
No, I think for those that are less committed in the license process, that don't have the backing and the money and prepared and give us an application without having a business plan, those are the ones that we spend time on, go through the process, and then ultimately they don't go forward. But we still spend our time on them.
Absolutely. All right. Fair enough. And I'm sorry, Representative Whitson. I've got a tall guy between us. I didn't see you very well.
No.
So, again, how many of you have 4,330 about applying? How many are going to actually make the process in every 2 years, and how many are given up or revoked? So I'm trying to figure out, what is the growth of liquor stores in this state? What are we looking at if, you know what I'm asking here?
These are licensees, so they're bars and restaurants and premises, not our liquor stores.
Okay.
I can give you that data in detail. I don't have it in front of me right now, but I'd be happy to submit that to the to the committee.
I'm up,
Chair. Yes, Senator.
As a former county commissioner, I can maybe answer that a little bit, because if the sheriff has had, for example, trouble at that facility, then we can help out, you know, the local governments help out by suggesting that the license not be renewed. So there would be various reasons in the partnership with the local officials as to if there's some history there that maybe the state would not know about. But I've seen licenses revoked because of local concerns.
Yes. Please continue.
Now, I would just add that apparently this bill's offered, or license fees have been offered in the past for various reasons. I'm informed it's got sidetracked, not on its own merits, but because it was caught up in other legislation. It does have the support of the Restaurant Association, and Bill Perry did testify that. With that, I'd switch to other related legislation. There's a bill in place to give us tobacco licensing responsibilities, more responsibilities around redemption centers. I think I noted that was already sort of a growing emphasis within our programs. Payments for business losses to liquor agents, that's particularly, I think, if privatization came into place, it would provide them with a buyout from the state. Funding for sobering centers and additional state police funding. On the legislation impacting the alcohol industry, I just point to three of the bills that are in particular, I think, most related to the interim task force work. The first is House Bill 2568 that would establish the Spirits Board. House Bill 2567 would provide greater opportunities for joint distillery tasting rooms. The key there is joint distillery tasting rooms instead of one distillery. And then at the bottom of the list, there's Brewpub and Distillery Package. That's Senate Bill 583. Senator Beyer introduced that bill, sort of the omnibus work that came out of the interim task force. And with that, I think we've completed, if there's no questions around those, the alcohol portion. I did, there was a question yesterday about how many officers we had in our regional offices. And I'll just run through that for you, if I can remember what page I wrote it on. Sorry, it's on my phone. The enforcement side in the Portland metropolitan area, and this one has some more detail than the others, there's 8 licensing personnel in Portland, 18 liquor inspectors, a technician, a manager, a director, and 2 dispatchers. So in the Salem region, 7 regulatory specialists and 1 manager. In Eugene region, 9 regulatory specialists and 1 manager. In the Medford region, 7 regulatory specialists and 1 manager. And in the Bend region, 8 regulatory specialists and 1 manager. We have provided you with an organizational chart that details where they are.
Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
I'm sorry.
Please.
Thank you. Could you talk a little bit about funding for sobering centers? This is something that's really important in my district, since we don't have a sobering center, and it's something we could really use. Anybody know anything?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt. So we always like to see our alcohol funds spent on related activities, but you know, frankly, as the commission, we earn the money, we don't spend the money. You make those decisions in the distribution formula and legislation about the spending and the purposes for which it goes. I know my friend, the chairman here, is from that area, may have something else to say on it.
I'm good, and it's needed, but yeah. That's a fiscal decision for you guys to make.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions before we move on? Yes, Senator.
Just a quick question for the Director Marks. You kind of briefed us a little bit, but I want to make sure we can flesh it out a little bit, and that is the rule change for additional expenditure limitation to encourage more exclusive stores to become non-exclusive stores. Could you, what are your thoughts, the best way to implement this concept? What, can you fill us in a little bit more on that?
Certainly. Jerry Gomberg, Senator Hansel, remember this is a concept outside of the governor's recommended budget, not requested by us. We could achieve the same means within the dollars available. But let me see if I can, if you move from exclusive to non-exclusive, our base rate actually that you get paid drop. There's both a base rate and a variable rate. But it's the base drop-in that's really become potentially the disincentive to make conversions to the new beer, wine, spirits type retail establishment.
Sure.
The proposal, as I understand it, by the agents would what they desire is to maintain the base they're at, even if they convert to non-exclusive. We can implement that within the dollars you give us, within our limitation on a current service roll forward basis, but then we have to spread the pain throughout our system, meaning others in the distribution will get less to maintain the higher base payment, or you can budget for the difference, which is $600,000 plus, and that would allow us to just maintain the base when they convert going forward.
Ms. Senator Johnson, welcome back.
With apologies, nothing like coming in late and then having an opinion. How is the scenario that you just described equitable to those that already made the conversion?
Because by virtue, we would, if you, so in their proposal, if you took the instruction, we would go back, if you provided instruction to accomplish the same, you would tell us to go back to the pilot program and move up all of those agents that had converted to date.
Thank you.
So it would restore to them basically the base everyone else was at, and then would allow everyone in the future to convert and maintain base.
Follow.
Please.
Is that policy direction encompassed in the pricing that you have now, or would that change the $600,000 to something else?
No, that's encompassed in the $600,000 proposal.
Any other questions before we move on? All right, I think if I'm not mistaken, we've got about 35 slides in the marijuana subject area. We got about 55 minutes, but we do have a fairly light agenda tomorrow, so if we don't get done today, we can carry some of that over.
All right. Well, I'll jump in very, very quickly. Co-chairs, again, Rob Patridge, chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. We're here today, and Tom Burns is run up to join us. We did want to put a caveat out there related to the marijuana budget. The commission is certainly trying to get its arms around what a marijuana budget is going to look like, and the staff is trying to do the same. We want everybody to know on the committee that this is a work in progress. We are, the number that you've been given is really the plug number that we provided ultimately that was decided on by the group that reviewed the ballot measure for the fiscal impact. There's certainly a lot of maneuvering, and whatever direction the legislature makes a decision on related to what your colleagues in the Measure 91 committee are doing, which could be large and could be rather narrow, depending on the votes in the building, could substantially change this budget. Just in terms of, you know, types of licensing, do we want service permitting licensing, meaning that people who sell across the counter? There's a variety of things out there that could substantially impact this budget. So with that caveat in mind, we're looking forward to working with this committee as we continue to move forward related to this budget. So Tom's going to kind of give you the broad strokes, but we certainly will be back, and we certainly are looking for your input. I would tell you that one of the commission's largest concerns is really that we get the technology piece on this budget right. Ultimately, as you guys look at the budget in the near future, I think that everybody wants to make sure that technology piece is right up with the seed to sale system, as well as the online licensing piece related to this budget, so we can track this through the system, and the system, as we roll out recreational marijuana, has some integrity. So with that, I will, unless there's any questions for me, I'm going to kick the ball to Tom Burns, the Director of Marijuana at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
Welcome, Mr. Burns.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Does Mr. Burns' card reflect that title, Director of Marijuana, OLCC?
I don't know what his card is. I haven't read his card.
Pop boss.
Nope, not that one.
Yeah. Director of Marijuana Programs.
Cool.
We'd like to submit in the record for us as an exhibit. You're on.
These high marks.
Co-chairs and members, I am Tom Burns. I'm the Director of Marijuana Programs for the OLCC. And on a light note, for the next 50 minutes or so, I'm going to tell you how we're going to aid and abet in committing a federal crime. So if you're nervous about that, maybe time to leave. Having said that, I do think it's important to understand what Measure 91 does and does not say. First of all, Measure 91 is and will continue to be illegal in the state unless it is done within some very narrow parameters. It must be consumed by an adult. It must be consumed in a private residence. It can only be grown for personal use or by an entity licensed by the OLCC. Unless distributed by an OLCC entity, it can't be done. You can't possess more than 8 ounces of dried product, 16 ounces of solid product, which is a policy question that needs to be addressed. Is the solid product the brownie, or is the solid product the wax that you can make, which has a very, very high THC? And 72 ounces of liquid form, again, is the liquid form the energy drink that has marijuana added to it, or is the liquid form the highly concentrated concentrates that are made in this industry? You can't transport more than 1 ounce, and it can't be grown or consumed within 1,000 feet of a school. Recreational marijuana will not be legal on July 1st, as everybody believes, if it's not consumed within 1,000 feet of a school, if a minor possesses it, when it's sold to the public by anyone other than a licensed OLCC entity, if it's consumed in public, if it's transported across state lines, if it's grown on federal estate lands, or if it's used while driving. In other words, yes, marijuana is legal in a very small box.
Quick question.
I'm sorry. Yes, Senator.
What if your home is within 1,000 feet of a school?
Co-chairs and Senator Hansel, it is my understanding that under both current statute, current criminal statute, as well as federal statute, you cannot consume marijuana within 1,000 feet of a school, even in your private residence.
Senator Johnson.
Interesting nuance that a fact scenario in Astoria gave rise to, and that is within 1,000 feet of a school, but you can have a coterminous wall with a daycare center. And I just wanted to put that on the record. It's that kind of subtlety that I think we're going to have to make our way through. Because while the kids aren't going to be smoking it, we have those shocking reminders of the DHS workers smoking medical marijuana while they were taking care of other people's kids. So I think it's a real issue.
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, you're right. As you may know, I ran the medical program for, I started the medical dispensary program, and you have identified one of the key policy questions that needs to be addressed is a daycare or a preschool a school as defined in federal and state statute? Yep. So what does Measure 91 do? It establishes a license for the commercial production and sale of marijuana. It tasks the OLCC with collecting taxes when the marijuana is sold by a producer or a grower. It provides tax revenues to addiction treatment schools and law enforcement. This tax is provided to them on a monthly, the revenues from the tax provided to them on a monthly basis. It provides for the regulation by OLCC of a commercial recreational marijuana market. That's what we're essentially building is a brand new market. There are 4 licensing types. We have the producer. I hit on the producer. That's the grower. Why they call them producers, I don't know, but it is a grower. It's people who actually grow the marijuana. They are the only licensed eligible to cultivate marijuana and sell marijuana into the supply chain. You then have processors. They package and label marijuana items. They can make concentrates. They can make food. They can make other marijuana products. And again, they can only buy from a licensed grower and then sell down the supply chain to a retail outlet. You have wholesalers that could be in between those. They can consolidate purchases, distribute as a wholesaler. And then you have the retail store, which is authorized to sell marijuana only to adults over the age of 21. I mentioned in joking that you know, we are in the process of committing a federal crime here, but marijuana is still illegal as far as the feds are concerned. But they have given states that have run medical programs, or the now four states that are have legal marijuana, some guidelines that says if you follow these guidelines, we will sort of turn an eye and maybe not come in and arrest your people. It's not quite that black and white, but it does set out some guidelines for the control agencies. Among those is obviously, as I've said many times, prevent access by minors. You cannot let a minor get a hand on the product and still meet the federal requirements. You must prevent criminal activities involvement in the sale and production. And so, again, we don't want the drug cartels coming in and using this as a means to launder their drug cartel product or money through the state of Oregon's legal system. It must prevent diversions to other states. And this is why the seed-to-sale system becomes so important, and we'll go into that later, is we must know where the product is in the state from the time it's grown until it's ultimately sold to the final consumer to assure that there is no diversion outside the state. We have to keep it from growing on or distributed on public lands. And obviously the whole DUI question and driving under the influence and how the state addresses that. What are OLCC's responsibilities? Tax, license, and regulate a brand new industry. There are, as we said, four types of licenses: producer, processor, wholesaler, and retailer. Each one of those licenses has certain duties, certain responsibilities, certain standards, and we'll build those as we build the rules. And we're required to meet statutory deadlines. While the deadline of July 1st is not ours, it does become important when we talk about an education campaign that we want to request funding for. And then OLCC is required to accept its first applications no later than January 1st of 2016. We could collect them earlier, but quite frankly, given the complexity of this business, we're going to be lucky to make January 1st of 16.
Sorry, Representative Whitson, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Are you going to limit or test the THC content of the marijuana, and are you going to not allow GMO if we don't have GMO? Because most of the high THC content is GMO, and the other stuff is apparently not very good, and people don't want it. So, as I understand, I don't use it, but
Co-Chair Gomber, Representative Whitsett, the answer is yes, we will test. We may need an additional license to test, and that issue has been presented to the Measure 91 Committee as something that they need to look at. The issue of whether marijuana is a GMO product is something that I'm going to let people far smarter than me debate. I think you could present the argument that every single product that we currently eat is GMO, since somebody discovered that you can move a gene from one plant to another. So I'm not going to get into that, but that is a question that somebody may choose to address.
Thank you.
Other questions? Burns.
I got ahead of myself here. Hang on a second. Oh, no, I didn't. Sorry. Differences from alcohol. So we are the alcohol agency, Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I think it's important as we build this program to recognize that while the campaign and the proponents talked about that they were simply mirroring some of the alcohol and beer and wine law, there are a number of significant differences between the two products and the way we're going to govern them. First of all, as I said, the seed-to-sale system. We will track from the time the plant is planted until the ultimate product is sold to the consumer. Under current law, under Measure 91, we have no peace officer authority, whereas the alcohol side does. In marijuana, individuals may hold multiple licenses in the supply chain as well as multiple licenses across the various types of licenses. So one person could be a grower, a producer, a wholesaler, and a retail outlet holding all four licenses. No licensed establishments for public consumption. The legislation is very clear. There is no public consumption, so you will not find a marijuana bar where you could go in and buy your bud or your brownie and consume with your friends in that bar. You must go into a private residence to do that. There are very specific home production and personal possession limits. Unlike a wine cellar or somebody who likes to buy spirits in bulk, there are limits of how much you may possess in your personal possession. It's 4 plants if you're going to grow your own, and we said 8 ounces of a bud, 16 ounces of marijuana, and 72 ounces of liquid. The 1,000-foot rule from schools is something else that we have to be careful of. There's no specific provision for local government involvement in our decision-making process. On the alcohol side, there is a role. On the marijuana side, there isn't. There is a license application fee, which does not exist currently for alcohol. And there's no bonding or insurance requirements, which means our good friends who decide that they want to skip out on the tax, there is no bond that would require the tax to cover the bond to cover the tax. These issues have been raised to the Measure 91 issue, but it shows part of the problem we're having as we build this new system. Timelines. We've been, since the initiative passed, we've been on a listening tour. The chair is leaving tonight to hold a listening tour in the southern part of the state. We've been to the east. We've been in Eugene and Salem. We will ultimately end up in Portland and finally on the coast conducting listening tours to hear what the public has to say about how this ought to be implemented. As you know, you're in session. That means you can change the law. This is an initiative of statute, not a constitutional amendment, unlike our friends in Washington and Colorado, which was a constitutional amendment. Ours is a statute, so the legislature could change that. On July 1st, a little more than three and a half months from now, it is legal to possess marijuana and to grow marijuana at your home within certain limitations. We anticipate our rulemaking process will start soon after the listening tour. We will release a draft set of rules based on current law. Obviously, as that changes, we will have to change the rules, but we need to start a dialogue about what the rules are that don't get changed. In November, we expect to go to the commission with a final set of rules for them to adopt so that in January 4th, we can begin to accept license applications. Application fee revenue will obviously begin.
I'm sorry, Senator Johnson.
Yeah, I want to stop there at the application for licensees for just a second. The process, and I say this respectfully to Mr. Marks and the chairman, the process for selecting liquor agents has at times seemed terribly subjective. You've got a number of objective criteria, financial capacity, but it also has had a sort of subjective element to it. Talk, if you would, a little bit about the process for reviewing the applications from licensees. Market saturation, requirements for the configuration of the stores. What sorts of things are you going to be looking at that would fall into that subjective range?
Yeah. Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, we're still building the rules. The initiative has some very specific things that we have to take into account. Among them is there enough capacity in a geographic area to support demand? Obviously, this was the old liquor laws that stemmed from, you know, if you can't just have one liquor store on the coast that gears up for 3 months in the summer and then disappears. We will, by rule, define things such as security systems. We'll define things such as point of sale systems. Those are the types of things that we're still building. But the application process, unlike alcohol, is anybody who applies and meets it, we can issue a license to, as opposed to where we are in alcohol, we are have a slightly different process to say. We may not approve everybody that comes in the door.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
I think what informs my question is that on the news periodically, as Colorado was implementing their program, they were showing pictures of some of the, they're not really tobacconists, they're dope shops, and they were exceedingly high-end, and it dropped many of us of a certain age back to the old Haight-Ashbury, mystique. Those are pretty gross places, and whether or not they're, and some of the medical marijuana, no disrespect, are not exactly upscale shopping experiences. And so with all the conversation that we've had previously and the conversation that we had yesterday about asking liquor agents to bring the ambiance of their retail establishments up, talk, if you would, a little bit about the enforcement, the if maximizing sales for the taxation benefit is one of the beauties of this ballot measure, and I think that remains to be seen. But talk a little bit about what you're going to be looking at in terms of the retail experience.
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, I will admit that the medical program did not quite turn out the way I had originally envisioned it. Part of that was having to do with the way the law was written. I think the provisions of Measure 91 give us the authority to make these as classy a location as we choose to make it, with some restrictions. Obviously, you don't want to make the require them to be so classy that you drive the price up where there still remains an illegal market. So we have to walk a thin line there. On the issue of enhancing tax revenue, while we will be enhancing the demand side, remember the tax is paid by the grower, not the retail outlet.
Thank you for the correction.
Yeah. And so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't really change tax, although it does change demand, and obviously the grower is supplying demand. The other issues you raised are all issues that clearly will need to be addressed through the rules process.
Yeah, and Madam Co-Chair, I think from the commission, Rob Patridge, OLCC Commissioner, from the commission side of things, I think we're looking at these more as a licensee like we would license a bar or a restaurant or someone like that, whereas we don't have the same agency relationship and controls that we would have on a liquor store. So I think that's the distinction that we're trying to get, and how do we set the rules that we don't encourage the black market because we've priced them out of their ability to locate those.
That distinction is very helpful. Thank you.
So going on, we will see our first revenue to the program in January of 2016 when the applications come in. Yeah. License fees, the application fee is $250. The license fee is $1,000. As we approve licenses, we will start seeing license fee revenue come in. It is our current thinking that we will issue producer licenses first. Obviously, you need to have the product in the retail outlet, and so we've got to license the growers first, which means that they will be putting their seed in the ground sometime in March. Harvest could be as early as 3 months if you're indoor, or as late as 6 or 8 months if you're outdoor. So sometime starting in the July range, we will start receiving tax revenue. And then we anticipate the retail establishments opening up after we have enough product available sometime in the mid to late 2016.
In just a moment, Senator, if I could. Mr. Burns, $250 for an application fee for marijuana retailing, $150 for alcohol. Are these applications more complex, or is this just market-driven?
Co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, the initiative itself set the application fee license fee.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
I had an interesting conversation with a constituent over the weekend who lives on Savis Island and wants to grow wine grapes and has discovered that in Multnomah County there is a specific exclusion for wine grapes in the agricultural deferral. Will growing marijuana qualify for an ag exemption?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, that very issue is being debated right now in various circles and will ultimately have to be resolved by the Joint Measure 91 Implementation Committee.
I better get to Senator Burdick quickly. I've got 5 fallow acres and I'm seeing a career opportunity.
I'm just going to move right on to Senator Hansel.
Thank you. I'm just curious, what happens with enforcement between July 1 and January 4th, even later? Because you're not licensing anything, and yet it's legal. And what?
Co-Chair Senator Hansel, we need to remember there's two provisions in Measure 91. One is a provision that makes marijuana legal, and that goes into effect in July 1st. The other provision is the provision that establishes a new industry in the state of regulated sale, production and sale of marijuana, and that is the one that will go in late. Enforcement, that's an issue why we are asking for peace officer status. That's the issue why we are also working closely with our law enforcement partners to help make sure that, we can work hand in hand to make sure that, frankly, people follow the rules and the laws.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Gomberg. Mr. Burns, right now it's legal to grow marijuana in Oregon if you're growing it for a medical operation. So theoretically, I could apply for your license on January 4th and get granted that, however long it takes you to, do that, and then legally start putting it into the chain. And Mr. Patridge is saying no. So set me straight on that then.
Yeah. Co-chairs, Representative Nierman. Yes, you can grow if you have a medical card and you are, you're allowed to grow as a, as an individual. You can grow for four patients at six plants each, which would be 24. If you and your spouse or partner, business partner, want to grow in a particular location, you can start what we call stacking cards. So if there are two of you, you can grow 48 plants. If there are three, it's 72 and 90, et cetera. The policy question of whether medically grown marijuana will be allowed to be converted and sold in a retail outlet is a policy question that has not been answered by the Measure 91 Commission.
Thank you.
Representative Whitson.
So during this time, will law enforcement be arresting those who are standing on the street corners or in the parks smoking marijuana?
Co-chairs, Representative Whitsnett, it is illegal to stand on the street corner and smoke marijuana, and our law enforcement partners know that and should take appropriate action.
I want to follow up. At Christmas, our daughter came home from Seattle on Amtrak, and she was in a regular car, not a health car or whatever, and there was a woman who smoked pot all the way from Seattle to Klamath Falls. And Amtrak said they could not do anything about it. And she said people were really distressed. They were moving to other cars. And the woman said, it's medical pot, and I can smoke it on Amtrak because it's a federal, I don't know. It didn't make any sense to me at all. But Amtrak apparently is not sort of intercepting people who are smoking pot on their trains right now. Just FYI, as they travel through Oregon.
Co-chairs, Representative Whitsnett. I believe that if she had started here under the provisions of Measure 91, it would be illegal for her to take that product across state line, even if it is a medical product.
But she started in Washington, so it was headed
It is illegal to import marijuana into this state under the provisions of Measure 91.
Okay.
The fact that she is a medical card holder in this state does not give you the right to consume in public.
Okay.
I don't know Washington's law.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Yes, Senator.
A quick question, if I may. Legal in a person's home, do you have to own the home in order to do that? For example, if I've got a rental or an apartment?
Yeah. Co-chair, Senator Hansel. All current real estate and employment law remain in effect. So if you are renting your home and you do not want marijuana smoked, or if you do not want somebody to smoke cigarettes in your home, you can put that in a lease and enforce it.
All right. I think that's the questions for now. Where were we?
Well, we're going to talk about some of the challenges that we have as we begin to implement this. First of all, as the chairman said, this is a brand new program for this state. It is not, there's nothing, even the medical program that I ran is not a good place to look back to. Made some mistakes, and so I'm looking forward anyway. There's no similar program in Oregon. We are only the third state in the nation to implement a recreational program. Washington and Colorado do provide some guidance, but there's the laws in those states compared to our law is significantly different. Also, Washington has no established medical program, despite your train rider. Colorado has a much stronger medical program, is a much closer model for what we might want to do, but the whole medical program complicates this. And as I said, the laws between the states, it is difficult to say that the way Colorado or Washington is implemented is what we ought to adopt, because the laws are different. Now, some broad categories like minors and labeling and things like that you can do, but other parts of it are very difficult. There were no implementation resources for OLCC included in the measure, which means the measure passed in November of last year, and OLCC had no resources. I was loaned by OHA to come to OLCC to help them through that transition, and then the e-board in December granted $583,000 in four positions to the OLCC in order to start and bring on some staff and start working on this. And we've asked for an additional $750,000 in this current biennium before the July 1st biennium, before July 1st, in order to take other steps. Obviously, the sooner we can get working on this, the easier it will be for us to meet the January 4th deadline, and the better job we'll do. How will we implement this? Well, first of all, a complete transparent public process. All the rules processes are going to be transparent. Like I said, the listening tours, we're going to be out there listening to the public and listening to you and working with you and the legislature to make sure that we are following what you want us to do. We're going to develop rules and processes to prohibit minors from being involved in this. We're going to work hard on the whole public safety issue, not only the question of how much THC might be in a product, but how much product should one person take at any one time. The whole question about the DUI and the safety on the roads need to be addressed. We're bringing an unregulated industry into a regulated market, and that's something that is proving to be lots of fun and interesting. We need to make sure that we are preventing diversion of the product from the Oregon's legal system into the black market. We need to partner with our law enforcement friends and, as I said, address the DUI standards and issues, which we will do in time for the 2017 session as required by the initiative. A little bit on public engagement. As I said, we've been out on the road. We wanted to do listening tours in order to get a sense of sort of what the questions we ought to ask. We put up a one-week survey out in the blogosphere, had 16,000 responses to that survey in 1 week. We've been in Baker City, Pendleton, Salem, and Eugene.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry. Yes, Senator Johnson.
Apropos the customer survey data that we saw yesterday, where in 2009 one case had loaded the data on customer satisfaction with OLCC, what ensured the integrity of your poll so that it wasn't loaded with guys with a particular point of view?
Yeah. Co-chairs and Senator Johnson, nothing. It was simply, here are six questions that we would like you to ask. We did ask who they were, so we knew whether you were a grower or a parent or a law enforcement or a local government. We cross-checked it that way. But there was nothing that said, you know, if you lie, you're in trouble, or keeping somebody from answering it 28 times.
Did any follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Did any patterns emerge? For example, I know that local government has especially struggled, municipalities and counties, and has a certain set of concerns, I presume, producers that are looking for a profit or motivated by profit have a different set. Did you see any patterns out of the responses?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, absolutely. And we do have an analysis of that survey, and we'd be happy to share it with you. Certain things clearly rose to the top of that survey, which is what we then used to build our listening tour. So yes, we can get that to you with cross tabs and that information.
And I guess the final question would be, it has been just my opinion, and that's all, that there has been a desire to accommodate the proponents of ballot measure 91. The mantra is the people passed it. Well, the people passed it, I think, potentially with some unintended consequences. To what degree do you see any philosophical penchant to want to accommodate, let's say, the concerns of local government? there are partners in serving the same constituencies, and I'm just trying to gauge how sensitive either OLCC or OHA or the Joint Committee is going to be in accommodating their concerns.
Maybe I should take that question.
Well,
related
to, I'll be happy
this
to
is,
as well.
For the record, Rob Patridge, Chair OLCC. Co-chairs, I would tell you that we are trying to, at the OLCC, reach out to local government. We've done, ahead of every listening tour, we've invited in everybody from local government, every county commissioner, every member of every city council and mayor in the local jurisdiction, as well as chiefs of police and sheriffs. We've had varying levels of participation by a local government, but we've continued to work hand in hand with local government to make sure that they're heard. I would say that our data on the survey was about a third local government kinds of folks, self-identified. So, you know, it's hard to, it's really hard to judge. And I would tell you that, you know, we've had these listening tours, but I would tell you that about 85% of those who grow up have an interest in the marijuana industry, are at the medical level, at the current medical level, as marijuana entrepreneurs or otherwise. So those with an economic interest are certainly showing up, as they are in the building. The lobbyists that are coming to all of your offices as they trail us are certainly proponents predominantly. We're not hearing from the average citizen. But what I would also say is, you know, the Measure 91 committee is wrestling with, and it's obvious to tell by the members on the committee and their opening statements, whether you stay within the strict construction of Measure 91 or you go ahead and make modifications to Measure 91. I would tell you, after facilitating over 1,000 people, mostly growers, about 85%, the growers didn't understand what was in Measure 91 fully. And we spend our first 20 to 30 minutes in every presentation going over what Measure 91 really said. So even the proponents didn't know what was going on. And what I've told people is, we now have the benefit of Washington and Colorado, which we didn't have as people were signing the initiative petition to put Measure 91 on the ballot. We would, the OLCC as well as the legislature, would be remiss if we did not take into consideration the lessons learned, both positive and negatively, in both of those states. So I think that that's what we're getting. We put out the opinion survey related to this just to see what was out there. We certainly didn't try and do it from a scientific basis, but we did want to at least get out there and engage the public who was willing to engage. We've had a lot of questions, and we are working very, very hard with local government to try and make sure that that input piece is done. And a lot of that is going to occur at the Measure 91 committee. A lot of the land use issues, a lot of the siting issues related to this are certainly large issues, but also the public safety resource issue that you all are going to struggle with as you try and fund public safety into the future, and the concerns over drug recognition experts and all those kinds of things are certainly issues that that are outside the control of OLCC, but certainly something that we are continuing to pick up as we travel the state.
Thank you.
And Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, I do want to comment about OHA, because I absolutely agree with you that the process by which OHA approved dispensaries was flawed in their relationship with local government, and that stemmed entirely from the way the law was written. It said OHA shall issue a license, and this has may term in it, so we may work with local governments.
Thank you.
So we talked about the survey. We also have a web page, originalmarijuana.oregon.gov. You can go and visit that web page. We've had over 150,000 hits on that web page since it went live the day after the election. We have an email subscription list off that page with 10,000 lit names on it. Comments come through the marijuana@oregon.gov. If you want to send your constituents to there, you can send it to them. Send them there, and by phone, we do respond to those that come in. They've been fairly, we now have it down to science. We know how to respond to them. We seldom get one that's a surprise. Rulemaking hearings will, like I said, occur in March and run through October. And commissions meet. The commission meets every month, and we'll be making policy decisions that will help direct us as we craft the rules over the next 8 or 9 months. So let's talk a bit about how we're going to prevent access by children. Obviously, as I said, no access, no advertising to target kids. We think we can get to that. We think we can take off the issue of the gummy bears and the worms and the things that clearly were marketed, that could be marketed at kids. So there will be no marketing for kids. All product will go out in a tamper-resistant package. I wish I could say they were child-resistant, but there is no such thing. They're really senior citizen-resistant packages. We will build an education program around educating both the kids and the parents about the problems with marijuana and the risks of marijuana. We do have the 1,000 feet from schools, and we will be very active once they get licensed in doing many, many minor decoy operations to assure that no product, nobody's selling. And my personal view at this point, although we haven't got there yet in the rules, is a minor violation of sale to minor is a death sentence, and you lose your license for that. But we'll see whether we can make that sustained through the legislative and rulemaking process. Public safety considerations. We want to make sure that the licensed businesses are operating according to regulations and preventing access to minors. These regulations would include not only our regulations, but local government fire health and safety regulations. So we're not going to see somebody shoestringing together a bunch of electric lights in a warehouse to try and grow this. They will have had to meet code in order to do that. Prevent migration between the illegal and legal markets. Again, that's a federal requirement that we have to deal with. Support law enforcement in their efforts. If we see a problem occurring, we're going to work with law enforcement. We're going to immediately notify law enforcement. If we have public safety authority, then we can confiscate some product if we see problems. But we will partner with them. Test all products for not only THC and CBD count, but for pesticides, molds, and potency, and then labeling standards to assure that the products are clearly labeled for what they are.
Where will that testing occur, Mr. Burns? And will there be contracts let for certified test facilities? Are we going to get a forensics crew someplace in OLCC? What's going to happen?
Yeah. Co-Chair Senator Johnson, right now the testing issue is a little amorphous. In an ideal world, there would have been a license in Measure 91 that established a testing license. There is not. The Measure 91 committee is aware of that. What we have said to them is that what we want is for private businesses who want to test marijuana, they must go to the OHA ORLAP program, which is a program that licenses all laboratories in the state, that the business must get a license from ORLAP to say we meet the standards by which a laboratory will function, and then they would come to us and they would get a license from us to allow them to handle marijuana.
Thanks.
Representative Whitson.
So what kind of pesticides were you going to test for?
Co-chairs, Representative Whitson. Very good question. In the medical program, we put a list of 8 to 10 pesticides in the rules, and within a week, I was told that all the growers had shifted to different pesticides. We're going to work with the Department of Agriculture to try and answer that question, to understand what pesticides should be used or should not be used. And we could prohibit pesticides, so if we find any pesticide in the product is spoiled. Somebody smarter than me is going to have to answer that, and we're partnering with Department of Agriculture to help answer those questions.
I also want to, Rob Patrick again, co-chairs and Representative Woodsett, there's also some interest at the Measure 91 committee to put that in statute. We're talking back and forth with the committee as to whether those testing standards should be put in statute or we should maintain them in rule. I would argue from the OLCC standpoint, so we can be fleet afoot, and this is a new industry, that those probably should be maintained in rule as opposed to put in statute. If you want to put in that we should test generally for these kinds of things, I think it's great, but I think we've got to be able to maneuver, we've got to be able to modify as different chemicals are used, and we have to do the right thing for public safety as opposed to try and put a testing standard in maybe into statute. So that's what I would argue to the committee. But varying committee members have varying opinions, as every committee does in this building.
May I ask what eats marijuana plants as far as bugs? I mean, that's basic. Yeah. What are we trying to kill?
Co-chairs and Representative Whitsitt, it is generally red spider mites. And I don't know enough about how to grow marijuana, having never... I can say that, having never grown marijuana, yeah. I go back a long way, but having never grown marijuana, but I'm told that it is very, very susceptible to red spider mites, and once they get in, they do destroy the plant, and particularly the bud.
Okay. Representative Whitt.
A little protein with your...
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've heard stories about those who smoke but don't inhale, but this is a recreational program, and I suspect that involves... deep inhalation on the part of some, and I, in all earnestness, it's probably more health than safety, but are we prepared as a state to begin to deal with increased health problems due to potential increased smoking and deep inhaling? I mean, I can't believe that smoke is good for anybody's lungs. So, have we anticipated health problems?
Yeah. Co-chairs, Representative Whitted. I came out of the OHA, and when the medical program was assigned over there, we spent a lot of time working to answer that very question. The problem is, quite frankly, there's been no data to answer it because you can't study marijuana. You cannot do any kind of research on that subject. So we don't know the answer. I will also say that about 40% of Colorado's business is what's called edibles. That's the brownies and whatever. So I think people who are concerned about, as you say, inhaling deeply can get their marijuana from other sources.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eating it, I guess, is one avenue, but I can't help but think that there will be people that come down with some very significant health problems as a result of this. And as a state program, not unlike gambling and not like alcohol addiction, I have to believe that there's going to be some significant and adverse fallout from this, and we've had to deal with smoking or rather drinking and gambling problems, and I think we need to be prepared for health consequences of smoking pot.
Mr. Chair. Just to follow along with the issues raised by Representative Whitt, I have found it ironic that OHA is paying for cessation ads on the television and has a program to provide patches and counseling on the telephone and all the rest of that sort of stuff while we're simultaneously trying to figure out how to get people to deep inhale, apropos Representative Whitt. No need
to Representative Whitson.
I'm sorry, I have another question which shows what I don't know, but it's my understanding you can vape oils. And could you discuss how vaping fits into all of this with these little cartridges that some people use?
Sure. Co-chairs and Representative Whitson. Vaping is just like e-cigarettes that you take. You start with the raw plant and you concentrate that by running some fairly heavy-duty solvents through it, which pulls the THC out. They then boil the solvents off. That's when they tend to explode if you don't do it right. You read about that in garages and backyards, etc. So you now have a very concentrated product. You then take that product and you put it in these little cartridges and you heat it and inhale that. And that is vaping. You can not only heat the oils, which are about probably a 60-70% concentrate, but they also make something called wax or shatter, which is pushing 80-90% concentrate that is even a more intense high, and that you use in a water pipe bong type device where you heat it and inhale the product through that.
So just follow up, how are we going to manage that then? Are you going to have a whole subdivision of, and how is that different than hashish? Can you tell if you smell vaping, exhalant, if it's hash or if it's concentrated marijuana oil?
co-chairs, Representative Whitsitt, actually, if you would exhale after inhaling, from having vape, there is no odor. One of the serious problems with vaping is that you could be walking down the street and do that, and you don't know whether they inhaled a cigarette or they inhaled a marijuana vape pen. My experience, having worked for 2 years at the corner of 4th and Alder in the OHA building, I would walk outside, and I finally figured it out, that if they inhale deeply once and put the device in their pocket, it's probably marijuana. If they continue to inhale like people do cigarettes, it's probably a cigarette, although that is not a 100%. But there is no odor. There is nothing to indicate to you that they are, in fact, consuming in public. And it is a very serious problem. It's a problem not only for consuming in public, but my worry is for kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a number of pieces of legislation that talk about e-cigarettes and where they can be used, but kids are using e-cigarettes in their schools. And it is only one step from that to start substituting, and you don't know without taking it apart and having the liquid tested.
Well, Mr. Burns, this is fascinating. We're learning a lot, which I do appreciate. I also recognize we're only about less than halfway through the slides that you've got and quickly running out of time, but I've got a question or two, if I may. I wanted to go back to the advertising, because you outlined some limitations on advertising, but give me a picture of what this advertising is going to be like. Is it coming from the producers? Is it coming from the retailers? What are we going to see?
Co-chairs, Representative Gomberg, you can currently find magazines that advertise locations. You can find magazines that advertise different types of product, different types of growers. They're out there. They tend to be industry magazines. I have not seen any sort of escape into the public magazine. Willamette Week may have had one when I was over on the medical side. I can't recall whether, in fact, they did or not, but I have yet to see those advertising escape. I think you will see, I've got the best weed in town, come down to the 4th and Alder and buy it from me. I think you will see we have the cleanest dispenser, we have the cleanest business in town and the best pot, and it goes from there. We do have, and I'm not a lawyer, but I'm told we have a constitutional problem with putting too much limitation on that. I know Colorado and Washington, as far as kids, have tried very hard to prohibit advertising where kids might naturally see it, but that is a hurdle that we are all going to have to work together to address.
I'm going to hold on my other questions. Representative Witt, did you have something?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if this is the appropriate time. Are we about ready to leave this?
Well, I was going to hope that we could get to a breaking point, since we're certainly going to have to come back. And I know that everybody's got questions, because we're learning a lot here today.
Mr. Chairman, just a final comment on this. I'm very serious, and I am concerned about smoking. It's been decades since we had the Marlboro Man, and it's taken a very long time to wean the American public from smoking. And I see a potential here where we will have increased and very adverse impacts on the public's health. And I heard nothing from this panel to suggest to me that they're anticipating a problem and they're going to try and deal with that. I don't want to throw the gauntlet down here, but this is a presentation on this agency's program about this new program under Measure 91. I see a very serious and potential health impact here that I want to see addressed, and it will have a bearing on how I view this agency and its budget going forward.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, what I would like to say is there was a question first related to advertising, and that goes directly to Representative Witt, your point related to the seriousness of the agency and how we're going to handle the advertising and those kinds of things that we've got to deal with. We are certainly, and I would tell you, we have some severe limitations related to Oregon constitutional law and our ability to control part of the free speech issue. I would tell you that as an industry, as we've gone around the state, we have likened this to either alcohol advertising, adopting advertising similar to alcohol limitations that occur at the federal level, as well as tobacco regulations that occur at the federal level related to the advertising piece and those appeals. I would say that the majority of the people that we talk to as we've been going around, because it is a large concern, the public health concern is a large concern of the commission, is that there's an interest and strong support, I believe, related to trying to make this advertising and the limitation on advertising akin to tobacco. However, the Oregon Constitution, I don't believe, would allow us to have the same restrictions at the state level that are allowed at the federal level related to tobacco advertising. And since tobacco is a federal product, it makes it very, very difficult for us to thread that gauntlet. So we are certainly wrestling with those issues. We certainly have a different constitution than both Colorado and Washington State. And that is something that the commission is taking seriously. And that's something that, you know, that we are certainly trying to do from a public health standpoint. We also have a lot farther to go in this presentation. So,
Representative, you had something else?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I regret perhaps bringing up the Marlboro Man. The point I was making with that reference was that it was almost part of the American culture. And there was a great deal of tobacco going on in the larger society. We've moved away from that. My point was not aimed at advertising. My point was aimed at we have a program that may add significantly to bronchial problems, I don't know, cancer, a number of problems that result from smoking. And I would be most impressed if the agency were prepared to come forward with a program, not unlike you've done with alcohol consumption and with gambling, to address problems that people participate in these activities, end up with problems. And if it is a state-run program, I think we have an obligation to the public to make sure that we're prepared to deal with the problems that are a natural fallout of a program that we've sponsored. I recognize that your agency did not ask the voters to land this in your lap. I'm sorry it happened, but it has, and we need to be prepared, Mr. Chairman. This could be very significant health impacts here.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, we have approached the legislature related to and requested the co-chairs on the education piece before even the July 1st home grow provision, because we are concerned, we remain concerned about that. We're concerned not only about the long-term effects and the brain effects and those kinds of things that we have to deal with for those underage, but we're also concerned about the effects it's going to have on emergency rooms and other things across the state, because people don't know how to use marijuana in a responsible manner. It's not the ditch weed of the 1970s we're dealing with here. We're dealing with high quality, high quantity THC, and we are very, very concerned, and that's why we've actually come to the, you know, as a legislature, we've asked the committee to give us money so that we can actually participate ahead of the July 1st, 2015 deadline to try and deal with some of the public health concerns that you have. So please realize that we are trying to do this, and I know we're working together in this for sure.
Senator Monroe.
Thank you. The Marlboro Man died of lung cancer, by the way. This measure, 91, is statutory. I think we would be in serious error if we didn't use the fact that it's statutory, not constitutional, and establish the kinds of regulations that are necessary to the public health and safety of the folks that we represent. And I know from being a high school teacher for a while and from what I've read that marijuana has a dramatic effect upon brain development, for example, that marijuana may have serious consequences in terms of mental health. And so we need to take all these things into consideration and feel some not only freedom but impetus to pass the necessary regulations for the public health and safety of the citizens of Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator. Gentlemen, regretfully, I need to bring us to a close today. The co-chair and I have a pressing engagement around the corner. Otherwise, we'd keep going a little longer. Mr. Patridge, do I understand you will not be with us tomorrow?
I will not be with you tomorrow. I will be in Ashland leading the listening session in Ashland, which should be quite well attended from what we understand.
I have no doubt. Well, I appreciate you spending these 2 days with us. I will look forward to everybody else being back tomorrow. I'm going to go ahead and conclude the public hearing on 5520 for today. Ms. Deister, tomorrow, a quick overview. We've got about half of this presentation to finish tomorrow, plus...
Yes, tomorrow... I believe the Chief Financial Office has a few slides to share with you with regard to how OLCC fits in with the governor's budget. Plus, you are noticed for public testimony on OLCC's budget bill tomorrow. So, yeah.
So tomorrow we'll be smoking.
Oh!
That is to say, moving quickly. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing today and close this session of the committee.